From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Are Democrats softening their stance on Roland Burris? He is the former Illinois Attorney General named to take over the Senate seat the president-elect held. And why isn't Mr. Obama speaking out on the Middle East? Here to help analyze the latest political developments, we've got Democratic strategist Donna Brazile. She's an author and nationally syndicated columnist. And Robert Trainum, the D.C. bureau chief for the Comcast network CNN. How are you guys doing?
Fine. Well, Happy New Year.
Yes, welcome to 2009, and boy, are we off and running. Let's start out with a very serious topic, not like most of these aren't, but Gaza. And so the president-elect held a news conference this morning, and one of the big questions was why he hadn't spoken out more publicly about the violence in the Middle East. Here's what he had to say.
I will repeat what I've said before. We can't have two administrations running foreign policy at the same time. We simply can't do it. And so as a consequence, what I am doing is I am being briefed consistently. My national security team is fully up to speed on it. But the situation of domestic policy making and foreign policy making are two different things.
Robert, you have a situation where the president-elect has been speaking out consistently about the economy, but he also mentioned the attack in Mumbai, the terrorist attack in Mumbai. So why do you think he's making such a clear distinction between domestic issues and international issues and what he thinks he can speak on now?
Well, I think he's learning. He's learning exactly when the president should speak and when he should not speak. And obviously, he's not the president yet. But given the fact that the economic as well as the international situation is so dire, the president-elect and his advisors are saying, you know what, let's let the international incident play itself out. Let's let President Bush and Secretary Rice speak to this issue. But and as it relates to the economy, this is obviously where I have much more credibility. This is something where the American people are looking to him, meaning President-elect Obama, for leadership, because everyone knows with everything, but specifically with the economy, this is something that he is going to inherit. Literally within the next couple of days. So I think the president-elect is trying to have his cake and eat it too by saying, you know what, I want to engage fully on the economy, and let's let the situation over the Middle East unfold, and let's let President Bush speak on that issue.
Donna, this is one of the one of those moments in time where everyone sees a downside to speaking out, because there's very vociferous critics on both sides, or not just both sides, there are many sides to this issue of what's happening in Gaza. What do you think is important for someone in Mr. Obama's position to remember?
First of all, I think Mr. Obama is playing it just right. And it's not about his strengths or weaknesses. It's about, an international situation where it is clear that the president and the Secretary of State are both working in conjunction with our allies to determine what is the best course. They're, of course, now trying to figure out if it is possible for the UN to play a role in a peacekeeping role. This is a grave situation in the Middle East, and I don't think speaking out at a time when there are serious concerns about Hamas, using its missile capacity to send rockets into Israel, or Israel allowing not just humanitarian aid but other aid to get through. But longer term, President-elect Obama has said that the Middle East is going to be a priority. He understands that we have to get back to a two-state solution, that we have to find some common ground to ensure that both the Israelis and Palestinians are at the table, especially the Palestinian Authority. They seem to be the missing link in this whole category as well. But I think President-elect Obama is getting advice and briefing, daily briefings from Secretary Rice. And clearly on January 20th, this situation is not resolved. We will hear more from him.
All right, Robert, let me move on to the people who are going to be on Capitol Hill. We've got 50 new House members of the 111th Congress sworn in yesterday. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi was reelected to her post. On the Senate side, you still got a couple of question marks. One of them is Minnesota's Senate seat. And then you've got the other one, very high profile, Roland Burris, blocked from President-elect Obama's vacated seat, technically over some paperwork. But the question now is do you see, Robert, a softening on the side of Democrats as they look at the chess pieces on this one?
There is some softening. Harry Reid, the Democratic leader of the United States Senate, came out over the weekend and said that there's always room for negotiation. It's my understanding that he is sitting down with Senator Durbin, who is the senior senator from Illinois, and Roland Burr, the Senate designee, later on this afternoon to talk about this issue. Look, the fact of the matter is that there's one issue here that is dominating this conversation on the Democratic side. It's raw politics. If you take a look at the Constitution, and if you take a look at the qualifications for United States Senator, Mr. Burr definitely fits the qualifications hands down. In addition to that, regardless of what you or me or anyone else may think about Governor Blagojevich, he is still the sitting governor and he has the legal power to appoint a senator. In fact, the U.S. Constitution and the state constitution explicitly says that. Now, granted, he is under a cloud of controversy. There's no question about it. But from a legal standpoint, he is still the sitting governor, including to that is Senator Feinstein, who is the Democratic senator from California, who's the chair of the Senate Rules Committee that oversees this process. She came out early this week and says that virtually the same thing that I'm saying, is that Governor Blagojevich has the right to do this. The reason why the Democrats are dragging their feet on this is because they do not want a special election, number one, because they don't believe that they can keep that seat. But also, number two, the reason why they don't want Mr. Burris seated is because they don't believe that he can hold on to that seat in 2010, which is when he would be up for re-election.
Well, let me just jump in and get Donna in here, because I think that you've raised a number of different points. One of them, of course, about the governor being at this point, he's just straight up facing these federal corruption charges. In the end, a lot of people saw this as a very crafty move by the governor, but how does it affect the man who used to hold the Senate seat? We're talking about Mr. Obama, of course. Donna, how does it affect him, if at all?
Well, first of all, there's been a lot of backpedaling over the last 24 hours regarding this situation. And let me just say this. I think Harry Reid today, when he came out and made a statement that he had a very good meeting with Roland Burris. Roland Burris has returned to the state of Illinois, where he will go before the special legislative committee that is considering impeaching the governor to discuss his appointment, to make sure that it was done legally and proper, since so many of these allegations have been raised. There's also the issue of the Illinois Supreme Court and whether or not they will rule that he need to be certified by both the governor as well as Secretary of State. The Secretary of State, as you well know, Jesse White, an African-American, has stated that this is a technicality. But at the end of the day, the Senate Rules Committee will, at some point, I think, between now and the end of the week, receive this appointment. It will be a bipartisan hearing, and Roland Burris will be seated. I start with the conclusion that it is insulting and offensive to seat the appointee of the corrupt governor of Illinois. Unfortunately, the only thing worse than seating Roland Burris is the mess that will happen if he's not seated. So hopefully the committee, which apparently is considering what to do, will conclude that as ugly as it is and how it looks, the Senate is compelled to seat the person legally appointed by the governor of the state of Illinois. So this matter should be resolved, and we should go ahead and begin to see Roland Burris as the next United States Senator from the state of Illinois. I also said publicly that he should not have to agree to not running in 2010. That is insulting. I mean, let the people of Illinois make that decision.
Okay, I want to get to one more topic before we wrap up today, and that is Leon Panetta, the former chief of staff under President Clinton, selected by the Obama team to take over as the head of the CIA. And it came as a surprise to some key players in the Democratic Party, including apparently Senator Dianne Feinstein. Now, what is going on at this point? Has everyone made nice, Donna, within
no.
the—
No, no. It was a mistake not to consult the incoming chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee or the outgoing chair, Mr. Rockefeller. It was a mistake. President-elect Obama has called to apologize. Senator Biden said, the vice president-elect said, it was a mistake. Now, Senator Feinstein has made it very clear that she intends to hold hearings. Clearly, she had her own a pick. She had someone in mind.
Do we know who that is?
I believe he is the second in command now at the CIA, Mr. Bias, or I don't want to mispronounce anyone's name. But you know politics, and Robert, you know this, especially as Robert is a creature of the Senate, I'm a creature of the House. If you bypass or try to circumvent these senators, they will come back and tell you, excuse me, co-equal branch of government.
All right. And you get to weigh in, of course, Robert. What do you think, not just about the politics within Capitol Hill, but do you think that the fundamental questions about Leon Panetta, about his experience and whether he has enough in the intelligence arena, are those justified?
Yes and no. First and foremost, it is always justified to raise your thoughts and your opinions about whether or not someone is qualified or not to hold a very high-level position in government. There is no question about this, Farai, and Donna knows this as well, that Leon Panetta is a dedicated public servant who has been in and around Washington, D.C. for almost 40 years now as a former member of the Congress, obviously as White House Chief of Staff. He is qualified. There's no question about it. But to go back to Donna's point, which I totally agree with, this is all about an ego and a bruised ego. Now, granted, having said all of that, Senator Feinstein and Senator Rockefeller have a valid point. They should be consulted on these issues. But it's even more than that. It was a bruised ego, and President-elect Obama did the right thing by calling to apologize. Farai, welcome to governing. This is all about governing now, and he's going to make some mistakes moving forward.
Okay. Yeah. Well, each of you guys has literally like one sentence. What issue are you looking at in the week ahead? Donna?
Well, given the fact that we're about to have a transition in government, I am paying close attention to the rest of the president-elect's appointments, as well as this stimulus package. As Robert knows, the country is hurting right now. $1 trillion deficit, another $1 trillion on the way. I want to see if this will really produce jobs and not just some blue smoke and mirrors.
Okay, you really quick, Robert.
Very quickly, 1992, it was the economy stupid. In 2009, guess what? It's the economy stupid.
All right, we're back for seconds. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Happy New Year, guys.
Happy New Year.
We were speaking with Robert Trainum, the D.C. Bureau Chief for the Comcast Network, and Democratic strategist Donna Brazile, who joined us from NPR's headquarters in Washington. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. The nation's unemployment rolls are growing day by day. Earlier this week, we checked in with a man who's struggling to find work and keep his spirit strong. The story is getting the most attention on our website this week, and we've got Jeffrey Bennett with us, digital producer for News and Notes. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Farai.
So, you know, a News and Notes listener named James Smith was laid off from a manufacturing job back in September, and we spoke to him earlier. He came back on the show this week to offer an update. So what's been the response?
Well, much like the first time he was on the show, the reaction from our listeners has been swift and supportive. So first, let's take a listen to what he said on Monday's show.
The work I find here, they're saying I'm overqualified. What work there is being offered, and other people just aren't responding at all.
And so to that, a listener named Tiffany Elliott wrote, I can understand where Mr. Smith is coming from. I have 2 degrees, and I'm working on my master's. I have prior military experience, and I also had problems finding work in the U.S. I've been teaching in South Korea for the last year and a half. It's sad that I can't afford to work in my own country. And another reader named Jarrell Solomon wrote this. He says, I wanted to respond to Mr. Smith because I'm a veteran with similar circumstances. I was forced out of my position in 2002, and I've tried to find similar employment since that time. And Smith came back on the site and wrote a message of thanks to all the people who've been sharing their words of support.
It is really, you know, it's always just so important for us to hear from people as to what's going on the day-to-day. And I really appreciate it personally. But what else are our online folks talking about this week?
It's a topic from Monday's Bloggers Roundtable, a report that Michael Bell, one of the teens involved in the Louisiana so-called Gina 6 case, shot himself in the chest in an attempted suicide. A listener using the alias Miss Moon said this, instead of questioning what would draw this young man to the point where he decided to take his life, the response seems to be that he somehow owed the black community for sticking up for him and the other Gina 6 men. Way to show empathy. Hardly anything in life is ever black and white, period.
What about the inauguration? We're going to talk a little bit about that just coming up in our Bloggers Roundtable, but what are we looking at so far?
Yeah. Well, in addition to our coverage, we want every News and Notes listener who will be in D.C. to upload their photos and short videos via our Facebook page. So there'll be more about how and when to do that on our blog and on our Facebook page, which can be found by going to Facebook and searching for NPR News and Notes.
I personally enjoy it highly, and it's great to just see all the people who drop us lines, and I can't wait to see the pictures.
Yeah,
Jeff,
yeah.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Bennett is the digital producer for News and Notes, and he joined me from the studios of NPR West. Now we're going to head right into our bloggers roundtable and get some feedback on the Roland Burris news, plus a neighborhood ball for Inauguration Week. What's that? We'll find out. With us, media consultant Carmen Dixon. She writes the blog All About Race and also blogs for AOL Black Voices. We've got Jay Anderson of the blog Average Bro and education analyst Casey Lartig. His blog is The Casey Lartig Show. Hi, folks.
Hi, Carmen.
Hello.
So let's start with Burris. He went to Capitol Hill yesterday to try to claim the Illinois Senate seat that was vacated by President-elect Barack Obama. But he showed up without a key signature of the Illinois Secretary of State, was turned away, and now Democrats are waiting to see if the signature is actually needed for him to be seated. We got a bit of legal advice yesterday from Sherrilyn Ifill, and she said, well, yeah, apparently so. But this is a very odd conclusion to the presidential race, and then this seat opening up, and of course the issue with the governor, not small issues of him being currently under legal investigation and indictment. You know, Jay, you've been blogging about this. What are you looking at as you look at this?
I think it's amazing. I mean, I didn't have any idea that Chicago politics were this corrupt. I mean, Detroit looks at Chicago like, man, you guys need to get your act together, right? I mean, seriously, it's like a soap opera. It's like a bad reality show. I just think overall, you know, Burris should be seated. I don't particularly think, you know, either way I think you can argue all day whether he's qualified or not. I mean, I personally think he is if you look at the fact that he's won 4 elected offices already. But I think ultimately it comes down to the fact that the Democratic Party is pretty embarrassed by this. They want this whole Blago situation to go away, and they don't want any taint over this Senate seat, which is obviously a very important one. That said, seat Burris, you know, Blago, again, is within his rights because he has not formally been charged or impeached yet. Go ahead, let Burris be seated. And if Blago is impeached, then go ahead and let the lieutenant governor determine, you know, what's going to happen with Burris.
You're using the short and familiar for Blagojevich, which
sorry.
I've heard. No.
Yeah,
no.
We were just hanging out last night.
I myself have butchered it in the past, but I think I'm holding it down a little bit right now. But it's always interesting to me to see, you know, how many people are challenged by his name, let alone his ethics. But let's go back to this question of the Senate seat, Carmen. I just want to point out a couple of conversations that are going on. One of them is that Congressman Emanuel Cleaver said that this seat should not be viewed as, quote, the black seat, the Senate seat. But Congressman Bobby Rush asked Senate Democrats to seat Burris because there are no black Senate members, and he called the all-white chamber, quote, the last bastion of plantation politics. So what do you see in the intersection of those two comments?
Well, I had the benefit of watching cable news all morning and watching as Reid sat down with Burris and had the photo op to sort of counteract yesterday's disastrous, in my opinion, for the Democratic Party's Burris approaching in the rain, being turned away from this. I mean, it was disastrous. And now you even have Barack Obama coming out and saying he's a good man, and if he, you know, it's a Senate matter, but if he's seated, I will work with him. Talk about an about face. But the point is, they were scrambling. What I noted, the headline, as I rushed here, the headline in my mind was the secretary is, Secretary of the Senate, Timothy Wright is a player hater because it all comes down to this signature. So you have Reid reminding the press and all of America that Wright is an African American and that Burris says this is not a racial issue. So they are scrambling as hard as possible to keep race out of this. And they must have said in Reid's press conference about 20 minutes ago, 5 times, race is not an issue. So I don't know if there is an intersection, except that the race card was laid down, it's now visible, and they're trying to pull it off the table.
Casey, what do you make of the partisan politics in this?
You know, first of all, it's a shame that people like Bobby Rush are just so quick to racialize things. This is not We Shall Overcome. This is not Bloody Selma 1965 all over again. This is just one of those raw political struggles that goes on in this town. I mean, it's an interesting one, I guess. Now, my prediction is that he will be seated by the Senate. And the lesson for youngsters out there is that it's best not to go to a new job with a letter of recommendation from a known crook.
Oh, God.
All right? He probably could have gotten seated faster at Denny's or an electric chair in Texas than, you know, getting seated in the Senate.
Oh, my goodness.
And go ahead. Right, if I could just chime in, I think it's interesting that Bobby Rush is so adamant about this seat being replaced by a black candidate, you know, or a black senator, given the fact that if we rewind a few years ago, I think everyone will remember that Bobby Rush was not behind Barack Obama when he ran for Senate in the first place, because I guess depending on who you ask, it seemed like he was harboring some ill sentiments, given the fact that Obama ran against him and challenged him early on in their careers. So it's very interesting that now he's so, you know, adamant about the fact that we've got to have a black person in this seat, when that wasn't the case. I don't know. It seems a little self-serving, and maybe there's a motive.
You're right, but also Bobby Rush wouldn't be for Burris if Burris was running against him now. So, you know, I mean, it's just, you know, he's just seen black in this situation. So,
I want to move on to a couple of other political issues. We've got a lighter one in a second, but I wanted to ask the question, is political news viable? And that may sound strange when you've got one of the biggest political events coming up in, I mean, some people argue it's the biggest in a lifetime, but cable news shows and electronic media in general actually saw their huge audiences evaporate after the election. There were massive, you know, multi-million dollar viewer drops in basically in what was a huge audience for political news. And according to Nielsen Online, the biggest decline that you saw online was at popular news websites. Have any of you guys, Carmen, do you think that there is still as strong an appetite for political news? And if so, is that appetite changing at all, since obviously we're not in a situation of seeing all these different races, except for maybe Al Franken?
It's a tricky thing, because I must say my readership is, since November, is up 20%. So I'm wondering if it's, but I blog about all sorts of things, not just politics, and that maybe politics drew them to the site and they stay for other reasons. But I'm thinking that maybe purely political sites where you don't have a relationship with the writers, or we're watching on news and anchors become newsreaders, shall I say, not even anchors, become interchangeable, that there is an emphasis to turn off the TV. Also, because the news is so depressing, the economic news, there is, in the at least the run-up to the election and right after it, it was energetic, it was exciting, the possibility was exciting. Now, every time you turn on the news, it is really depressing. Myself, I've had to back away from cable news because I was just getting overwhelmed with the dire financial situation in our country.
Casey, do you think that that's part of it, that people are just having news fatigue, and you have people like the popular health expert Dr. Andrew Weil saying, take a break from the news for your health?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, people have been hearing about this big event that's going to be coming up, the election. So it's a lot like the NFL and the Super Bowl. After the game is over, people lose interest in the NFL, I mean, until the season starts up again. But there was that one big event that people are waiting for, so we shouldn't be surprised. Same thing, eggnog consumption is probably down in the last 2 weeks. You know, I mean, you know, these things
speak
happen.
For yourself. I've got it in the ice cube tray. No, but I mean, Jay, ultimately, for you guys who are all active bloggers, I mean, there are some very personal decisions that you get to make, and Carmen was giving good news about her traffic. Do you have a sense of whether or not the people who read and visit your blog they're wanting the hard news or the political news? Do you have any sense of the opinions of people on what they want?
I'm in the same boat as Carmen. My blog is not a political blog. I talk politics because obviously, I mean, that's what a lot of people want to talk about. But, you know, just like Carmen, my site traffic is actually going up since November. I think people had people were fatigued. They're tired. I mean, it's almost like, I don't know firsthand, I'm just judging on what my wife told me. After you carry the baby for 9 months, the last thing you want to do is carry a baby for 9 months. And, you know, this year's political season was just like that. It was more so than being political. I think this year was almost like a reality show. You had so many personalities. You had Sarah Palin. You had, you know, Joe the Plumber. You had Barack Obama and all the historical significance there. I mean, it's almost like watching the last 11 months or so of political coverage, it hasn't really been politics. So a lot of the people who got themselves ramped up and who were interested in this all of a sudden, you know, they're not going to be as interested in the soup and bolts and the day-to-day, you know, goings-on now that Obama's in office and he's appointing the cabinet. I mean, those are the less sexy, almost in office, I'm sorry. Those are the less sexy and less interesting, you know, aspects of the whole political process. And most people, you know, they jump ship. They were interested in all the theater, and now that's over. And again, I think, again, like Carmen said, if you're a blogger and you've got interesting enough material, on my site, you know, I've switched now to doing a lot more sports, a lot more pop culture, you know, a lot of things, again, that don't depend on you know, the political machine, and my site traffic has continued to go up.
Well, I want to transition into one of those points where politics and pop culture meet, and that is the inauguration. You've got now NBA stars, foreign dignitaries, and, of course, everyone from the hood showing up in Washington, D.C., or at least planning to. And a lot of people have been saying, well, what can I actually go to, whether or not I'm in D.C.? So there was an announcement that there would be a neighborhood inaugural ball that was actually hosted by or official with the president, because there are balls that are, you know, the official balls where he's definitely going to go around and visit. And then there's ones, there's a zillion other parties. But an official ball has a very specific status. And this one's going to be at the Washington Convention Center. There's going to be tickets put aside for local residents. But there's also going to be webcasting and texting and all of these. You know, so many people are going to be having house parties, or there's going to be street corner parties. Washington, D.C. delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton recently told NPR she's excited about her new neighbors and just all of the energy that this whole season is bringing.
They spoke out about reaching out to the district from the beginning. We're very pleased, of course, because we've not had a president who felt quite at home here as Barack Obama, but that's because he is one of the In fact, he is the first big city president in memory.
Of course, her neighbors are now the Obamas. Their kids started in school. Carmen, what do you think, just quickly, about the idea of trying to make the official process of the inauguration festivities open to more people? Is that a good idea?
I love the idea. I have no idea logistically how that's going to work. I've read everything, and I'm a former producer, and I looked at the logistics. I don't understand it. It's above my pay grade. I'll be there blogging it for AOL Black Voices, but I don't know how they're going to make it work.
Well, I mean, you know, Casey, do you think it's one of these things where maybe you might be better off sitting in your house with your computer?
Look, I'll tell you, I'm getting out of town during that week. You know, email me if you need a place to stay, because I'm going to be, yes.
Don't
I'm,
say that. Uh-oh. Everyone who you went to elementary school is now
dialing
your phone number.
Email me.
Already happened, right?
Hey, I know other people who have places trying to rent out. That's the only thing. I'm not interested. I'm going to be out of town.
Jay, what do you think? I mean, is this going to be a situation where no matter what goodwill goes into planning, things are going to be a little messy?
I agree. I mean, logistically speaking, you have no idea how to prepare for this sort of thing. Personally, I think a lot of people are going to come here and be disappointed. I think so many people coming from out of town think this is going to be a city that's easy to get in and around. But I think logistically, Metro has no idea what they're going to, you know, be dealing with. Personally, I'm going to be there for it. You know, our plan is just to go and take a train and get as close to festivities as we can. And as soon as the inauguration and swearing in is over, we're out of here. Because, again, it's going to be a zoo. A lot of people, like Casey was saying, you know, are getting out of town.
Oh, yeah.
I've seen now a trend I've heard a lot of people now talking about swapping homes with other people. You know, like, for example, I'll go to Florida and I'll take your home and you can take my house here, you know, for the week of the election. So, I mean, I'm sorry, for the inauguration. So, what? Really interesting time.
Well, in that case, if anybody in Hawaii is listening, you should have emailed me.
I think the Obama family might be on vacation.
Okay. I'll take their place, $9 million, whatever. I'll take it.
All right. On that note, guys, thanks so much. And if you're going to the inauguration, enjoy it. And if you're not going, enjoy it.
Okay.
We were speaking with Jay Anderson of Average Bro, Casey Lartig, whose blog is The Casey Lartig Show. Both were at our headquarters in Washington. We've also got media consultant Carmen Dixon, who writes the blog All About Race and blogs for AOL Black Voices. She'll be at the inauguration. And she was with me today at NPR West. You can find links to their blogs and ours at nprnewsandnotes.org. And the conversation doesn't stop here. Be sure and visit us online at nprnewsandviews.org and upload your pictures if you are celebrating next week. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Thousands of very wealthy investors saw millions disappear when Bernard Madoff's alleged Ponzi scheme collapsed. Late last year, the former chairman of the Nasdaq Stock Exchange was charged with orchestrating the largest investor fraud ever committed by an individual. Along with high-profile investors, nonprofits are taking a hit. In a moment, we'll speak with one organization that now finds itself without key support. But first, let's hear from Boyce Watkins. He is a finance professor at Syracuse University in New York. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So just to bring everybody up to speed, you've got Bernard Madoff. What specifically is he accused of doing?
Well, Bernard Madoff is accused of running a Ponzi scheme, which a lot of us have heard about, but maybe we don't understand exactly how they work. Basically, Ponzi schemes are really built on three concepts, and that's greed, ignorance, and viral marketing. And so effectively, what you do if you want to run a Ponzi scheme, which you shouldn't do because you'll go to jail for it, is you offer extraordinarily high returns to investment, which, because everybody is greedy, everybody wants to make more money, et cetera, et cetera. And then what you do is you rely on the ignorance of the investors, traditionally, historically, meaning the inability of the investor to understand complicated financial terms like global currency arbitrage, hedge futures trading, things like that. You make it sound sophisticated. And then you rely on viral marketing, because when people make money, they tend to talk about it. And effectively, though, at the end of the day, you're robbing Peter to pay Paul, because the initial investors get their returns, which tend to be very high, from the latter investors. And eventually the whole scheme comes crumbling down. And that's what Madoff is accused of doing.
How does this affect nonprofits?
Well, a lot of people invested in Madoff's scheme. It was the largest Ponzi scheme in American history. He had about $50 billion in assets. And so a lot of nonprofits were built on this. Very sophisticated investors were built on this. There was an investor in Europe who lost over $1.4 billion in this scheme, and he actually committed suicide in 2008. And, you know, effectively, a lot of nonprofits, pension funds, cities and governments across the world were investing in Madoff's scheme because he seemed to have figured out a formula to make a lot of money, when at the end of the day he was actually doing things that were unethical and ultimately illegal.
When you look ahead for the next 2 to 3 years, do you see this money reappearing for nonprofits specifically? Do you think people will find ways of replacing the funds, or do you think there's going to be a rough road for nonprofits?
Well, if they're looking for the money to come back from the Madoff scandal, the answer is no. You know, Madoff has spent a lot of that money, and a lot of that money will never be recovered. For nonprofits in general, I think the bigger threat to nonprofits is the economic downturn and the fact that a lot of charitable giving has declined substantially as a result of the economic struggles that we're having as a country right now. I do believe optimistically that within the year, the bulk of the recession will be over, and we can get back to business as usual, while at the same time there are some serious long-term problems in the economy which may not even reveal themselves for another 3 or 4 years.
It sounds like are there any potential sources that you can see that might replace some of the lost monies?
Well, you know, I can't really say for sure. I don't really think that that the model for nonprofit giving is going to change very much. I think that it's sort of like the weather. You know, when it's raining, you just come inside, or you get an umbrella and you wait the storm out. And I think that I know that here at Syracuse, for example, when we found that a lot of our giving had declined as a result of the economy, some of our investment strategies changed. Where we managed our money, how we allocated our funds changed. We tightened our belt a little bit, and the hope is that you wait it out and things will eventually get better. I don't think that the model for giving is going to change very much.
Well, it's great to talk to you. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
We were talking with Boyce Watkins, professor of finance at Syracuse University in New York and founder of YourBlackWorld.com. And last week we brought you a second listen to a story about work by the Innocence Project of Texas. It's a not-for-profit dedicated to overturning wrongful convictions. As it turns out, they're one of the organizations slammed by the Madoff scandal. Jeff Blackburn is the chief counsel there. Welcome.
Welcome, and to you, thank you very much for having me.
So we got to speak to your organization about Timothy Cole, who died in prison after being wrongly convicted of rape, a very tragic story, and one where you have been instrumental in exposing what's happened and working to exonerate him, and in fact having another hearing coming up in February. So what kinds of funds give you the resources to do this kind of work?
Well, until the news of the Madoff scandal broke, and it broke on us like a real tsunami, we had no way of seeing this coming. We were we had received a grant from an organization called the Jet Foundation, which funded a lot of our work in Dallas County, which has in turn enabled us to put a lot more volunteer effort into cases like Tim Coles and other parts of the state. But as it turns out, the Jet Foundation was pretty much supported solely by one donor, and that donor had all of their money tied up with Bernie Madoff's scheme. So the consequence, not just for us, but for dozens of criminal justice reform groups throughout the country, is that effectively our either primary or sole funding sources are gone. And frankly, we're scrambling here now. We are not in good shape. It's going to, fortunately, the Texas legislature is getting ready to convene, and it's going to be up to them to step up. You know, the state of Texas caused our problem here. And
what do you mean by that?
Well, sure. The state of Texas, through the system that we have created and let go on for the last 20 to 30 years, has turned itself into not just sort of a cruel joke in the criminal justice world, but a false conviction machine. It's not for nothing that we have gotten as many folks out of prison in Texas, especially in Dallas, as we have. There are certainly a lot more to get out here, and there are a lot of reasons for that. But the primary reason is that we've suffered from a convicted all-cost mentality. We have elected judges, elected DAs, and the net result has been that a lot of poor people who couldn't afford good lawyers have just simply been framed and falsely convicted.
Well, let me jump back into the finance issues, and certainly we do want to follow up as we have been on the big picture of what's going on in Texas and give folks a ping within the legal system there. But your whole reason for existing is because there are flaws in the system. So given that that's the fact, and given that you have to try to scramble to find this money, are you expecting the state to now pony up for the work that you're doing to challenge them?
Well, we're certainly asking them. Expecting much from the state of Texas is a tricky proposition, especially when it comes down to criminal justice reform. Although there are a lot of encouraging signs with this legislature, and I think that, frankly, a lot of legislators have now decided that there really is a crisis in this state with a number of folks that we've been able to get out, and that the Innocence Project nationally has been able to get out here. So we're hopeful that that they're going to have some impetus to really step up and do the right thing.
Finally, when you think about your options, you mentioned you're not in good shape. You're looking to the state. If the state doesn't ante up, could you close?
It's conceivable. Under the current setup that we've got, like, let's just say things remained absolutely the same, that there was no increase from the state, we would be able to operate a small clinical program out of one law school, but its ability to get much done would be pretty severely hampered. The key to us, because it's such a huge state and there are so many cases and we have a gigantic prison system, is being able to mobilize lawyers and volunteers and law students from all over the state instead of just one little town or one little region. So it's critical for us to really do our job right, to be able to get more money. In the meantime, we're preparing to do what the previous guest or the professor said, and that's, you know, we're looking to get the umbrellas out and try to get through this rainy day.
All right, Jeff, thank you.
Thank you very much for having us.
We were speaking with Jeff Blackburn, chief counsel at the Innocence Project of Texas, talking about the impact of the Bernie Madoff Ponzi scheme, alleged Ponzi scheme, on their funding and work. Now we're going to look at another issue of trouble and finance. We're talking about marriage. Now that we're facing the worst economic crisis in generations, what can be done to keep marriages from falling under the weight of it all? It's a question we're putting to Judge Lynn Toler. She's an author and the star of Divorce Court. Judge Toler, great to have you back on.
It's always good to be here.
So is it true that couples fight more about money than anything else?
A lot of surveys have said that that couples fight more about money than anything else. There has been some questioning about those surveys in that I think people are a lot more willing to proffer money as the reason for a breakup as opposed to other things. And sometimes it looks like money is the reason when there are other underlying emotional concerns. But it certainly is one of the number one stated reasons why people get divorced.
So if it's not money per se, what is it? Is it some people talk about ego tripping when it comes to money, people who have a sense that their self-worth is heavily tied or maybe primarily tied to how much money they make. And if they make less or make none for a while, that ego takes a hit. Do you think that that's part of the issue here?
I think that's a huge part of the issue. When people talk about money, they always want to talk about dollars and cents, and very rarely do they talk about their emotional relationship to money. Some people see money as security and safety. They want a lot of it in the bank. Other people see money as a statement about who they are. Some other people see money as power and the ability to do what they want. So if you don't understand what emotional type you are with respect to money and your spouse is, you two have stress and conflict because a dollar to Joe means something different than a dollar to Sally. So they're not even trying to attain the same direction, even though they believe they are. If there's enough money to go around, the fact that they don't need the same thing out of the dollar is not going to be so much of a problem. But once the dollar becomes scarce, who gets it and what is important becomes an issue.
Sometimes you hear about couples fighting over stuff. We need a new car. No, we don't need a new car. You know, rather spend the money on having the kids go and get braces than get a new car. But I need my ride to look good. You know, questions like that.
They come
up in families. How do you adjudicate if that's the kind of issue that's coming up in your relationship?
Well, you first of all have to make the people involved understand that that is actually the issue. Most people don't see it that way. When people say they want a car, they don't usually say, I need a car to look good. They usually think they really need a car. They don't understand that they're feeling an ego need. So you have to understand, get people to understand what their need is based on. And then when you figure out what their need is based on, you have to talk to them and get them to sit down with their spouse and saying, this need, we cannot afford to fill this need at this time, and maybe we can fill it some other way.
Who's your best advocate if you are someone who's going through these issues in a relationship, in a marriage, and trying to figure things out and not coming together, maybe being torn further apart even as you try to discuss things? Who should you turn to?
Your best advocate is some man or woman who's been married more than 30 years and have been there, done that. I experts are wonderful. I love them, but there's nothing like experience. And if you talk to people who have been through good times and bad times, what they did and how they did it, you would be amazed at the practical, precise advice that you could get. Yep, I did that. Here's what I did. And not give them general parameters or ideas or concepts, but actually tell them what they can do and what they did so you can work your situation and work your marriage like the job that it is.
Is it depressing to think about marriage as a job? I mean, there was an article that argued that women should settle in marriage and that settling was a good thing. I won't go into that whole controversy, but it compared marriage to a small nonprofit corporation and said it's just not going to be exciting all the time. What do you think of something like that?
I think that's absolutely true. And if you take anything worth doing is kind of like a job. I mean, you have a job where you're on the radio. You love your job, but it's a job. Marriage is a job in which happiness is one byproduct. Stability is a byproduct. But it is a job. And if you look at it like a job, it becomes a better and better job. You know what I mean? You get promotions. It gets better. So if you look at it like a job and work it like a job, you have more of the product happiness at the other end.
What if you just have reached the end of the road, or you believe you have, and you think that your only option is divorce, which is not always cheap? What do you do first?
Well, first of all, you have to question your decision as to whether or not you are at the end of the road. You're at the road if somebody's hitting on you. No doubt about it. You're at the end of the road. But you have to really question, am I at the end of the road? Or am I just at a beginning of road where I need help? You need to go to a marriage counselor to make sure that decision needs to be made. In this current economic situation where houses have lost value. I mean, it's unique in that sense. Sometime, and that's usually the biggest asset that anybody has, that has, and there's been a study done on it recently, compelled people who would otherwise divorce to stay together. So once you have made a decision that economically it is not feasible, you have to make it emotionally reasonable, and you have to do something to address the emotional issues that you have because you simply cannot get out.
If you just had one sentence of advice for someone who really does think that they've reached the end of the road, but the other person in the relationship says, no, we haven't, what would you say to that person?
Go to a marriage counselor. Go to a third party and work it, because you don't know where it went wrong, probably.
All right.
Or the other person doesn't know.
Well, Judge Toler, thanks for the advice. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Anytime.
We were speaking with Judge Lynn Toler, a regular contributor to this program. She's also the star of Divorce Court and the author of My Mother's Rules, A Practical Guide to Becoming an Emotional Genius. And she joined us from the radio station KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona.